December 25th, 1642, at Woolsthorpe in the parish of Colsterworth in Lincolnshire, a distraught pregnant widow was being attended to in a traumatically exigent and premature birth to a tiny and barely sentient baby boy. All authoritative opinions said he would be gone in a matter of days, if not hours. Harriet Ascoff assumed, having lost her husband months earlier, that his only progeny would soon be following him in death. Somehow, the little guy persisted, and he would not only flourish, but become one of the greatest intellects to ever put pen to paper. He would enter Cambridge University at age 18, define the parameters of modern science, provide theoretical writings that are still being explored to this day. Oh, and he would also invent calculus. He would be venerated at the highest levels and maintains an unusually high level of reverence in the world, even today. What you may not know is the man was one part scientist and two parts theologian, and not only didn't refrain from any perceived overlap, but always stated that the prior would always vindicate the essential core of the latter. That all planetary motions, ellipses, and core issues of matter and light proceeded from something far more omnipotent. He would go on to write a commentary on the Book of Daniel, examining Old Testament prophecies, and then follow it with a commentary on the Book of Revelation, collating the entire matter. He felt confident that not only would the apocalypse happen, but felt he could mathematically factor the second coming of Christ at the year 2060, although this date was an addendum in a notebook and possibly not something that he ever sought to publish. None of this controversial at the time. It would be his writing disputing the doctrine of the Trinity that threatened to marginalize his career. So he was one part scientist, part theologian, and depending on who you ask, one part heretic. We'll discuss the complexity of Sir Isaac Newton on box number 7. The late Stephen Hawking bears a few corresponding similarities to Isaac Newton, well, at least on the surface. Hawking would come to occupy the prestigious Lucasian Chair at Cambridge University, a mathematics professorship that was started by King Charles II in 1664, and it was an honor that has been held by, so far, by only 19 people, Hawking being the 17th, appointed in 1979, as well as a predecessor 310 years prior to him, Sir Isaac Newton. Now, Isaac Newton is rightly considered the father of modern science, Hawking considered one of the most notable heir apparents to that throne, for sure. Newton's magnum opus, known informally as Mathematica Principia, or Principia, depending on who you ask, is considered a literary holy grail of scientific literature. Its process is still being borne out in scientific circles, even to this day. But what set him apart from Hawking is literally God. Though it seems to be omitted from the common discussion, Newton's finest work was a literal expository proclamation of the order of the universe and then a summation that such principled order had to have an intelligence beyond measure that set it all into motion. Hawking, his greatest work, A Brief History of Time, attempts to make a cosmological argument in layman's terms, or at least what he says are layman's terms. I read it. I wouldn't say everything's layman's terms, but, you know, I'll give him that. I'll give him the mulligan anyway. And it was about the Big Bang, black holes, and the general trajectory of the universe. No mention of God, well, until the very last sentence. And the very last word, where Hawking makes an almost theological claim. And I quote, "However, if we do discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable in broad principle by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God." Unquote. Now, this last sentence actually perturbed the scientific realm that grew to become antagonistic to even God-adjacent terminology at the outset. Hawking later wrote a book sort of mollifying his discipline by essentially claiming that gravity alone was about to was the way to explain the ex nihilo nature of the Big Bang. But we'll come back to that at the end. Oh, and while Hawking is hailed as a metaphorical avatar for intelligence and genius, this isn't about him. It's about the man whom no one can hold a candle, a one Sir Isaac Newton, who is an unmitigated genius. Now, as stated earlier, Newton is credited with the invention of calculus, although another scientist was making the same breakthroughs independently. I'm not going to go into that academic debate, but it's there. At the University of Oregon, however, they state this about a young Isaac Newton. Quote, "Isaac Newton changed the world when he invented calculus. We take this for granted today, but what Newton accomplished at the age of 24 is simply astonishing. Calculus uses physics, chemistry, biology, economics, pure mathematics, and all branches of engineering and more. It is not an overstatement to say Newton's insight in the development of calculus has truly revolutionized our ability to pursue new branches of science and engineering. It is used in problems when a quantity changes as a function of time, which is how most problems behave in reality. When he invented calculus and outlined its uses, Isaac Newton made one of the most important breakthroughs in mathematics history, and it's still vital to this day." Unquote. So calculus wasn't invented by Newton in a vacuum or on some capricious turn of eating spicy foods before bedtime. As they say, necessity is the mother of invention, and Isaac Newton stepped up to the plate. But Newton was busy trying to describe the speed of a falling object. He was able to surmise that a falling object does gain speed the longer it falls, but realized very quickly there was no way to quantify this in solid language. Issues of movement like that, as well as changes in rates, were almost completely unexplored at the time. They probably were desired for expression, but there was no language with which to formulate them. Once he realized that he could carve out an explanatory language to not only explain this, but also explain planetary ellipses as well as the orbit of the planets, thus, and not to oversimplify things, calculus was born. A literal language in mathematical form was now handed to the world. And of course, even more breakthroughs in gravitational research would follow as well. But first, let's talk about this trajectory of this man's life, aside from his premature launch into the world via the birth canal. Newton was born, but after that, it turns out he was born into an Anglican family, and Isaac's mother, newly widowed, would marry the rector of the neighboring parish of North Witham, the Reverend Barnabas Smith. Newton apparently grew up to hate his stepfather and had little to do with him for his entire life. Newton grew up immediately becoming a fellow at, Trinity College, Cambridge, which also involved the taking of what are called holy orders within the 7 years of completing an MA degree. This involved a vow of celibacy and an outward recognition of the 39 articles of the Church of England. This would be his discomfort with things inside the ecumenical creeds that would cause him conflict down the line. He did not want to be ordained, though it was made law by King Charles, and he considered ceasing his studies, not because of atheistic concerns, but doctrinal ones. Ultimately, statutes were rewritten to allow this process to be avoided, and those after him. This extraordinary step, although originally taken to accommodate a man who would ultimately become a heterodox Protestant, ironically enough. Newton began to study the history of the early church, and at the exact same time, he began to develop his theories on motion and matter, which would result in the greatest scientific paper ever written. To pronounce it correctly, Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, formally known or informally known as Principia. Newton would meticulously lay out incredible calibrations visible in the universe and the mathematical measurements and the predictabilities. Then, in Book 3, he would begin to attach his summations about the hand of a creator involved in all of it. This was all natural extensions of Isaac Newton. Nothing was forced or contrived, but we'll come back to that in a bit. By 1672, Newton was already at work recording his theological hot takes on various notebooks and such. And over half of what he wrote concerned theology as well as alchemical writings. It was clear that he had extensive knowledge of the early church, as he would write that he fell sympathetic with those in conflict with the Athanasian Creed, and took to heart the idea that Christ was a mediator between God and man, and at the time he rejected the Trinitarian expressions from the Nicene era. Of course, doing this carried a ton of accusatory baggage. Some referred to him as an Arian, and no, not the white supremacist sect. This has to do with someone who was actively arguing to the contrary during the Nicene Council. And they also called him a Socinian or a Socinian, a version of Trinitarian rejection that rejects the concept of the eternal Son. In this vein, he wrote an historical account of two notable corruptions of Scripture. Yes, this is Isaac Newton writing this, in which he argues two Scriptures, 1 John 5:7 and 1 Timothy 3:16, were altered to accommodate Trinitarian doctrine. Either way, the irony is that Newton's religious beliefs threatened his scientific career, but those threats came from sectarian platforms, as opposed to the secular arenas of his discipline that would otherwise threaten a scientific career today. A complete 180-degree polar reversal of current events. One might be surprised to know that Newton also wrote two complete commentaries. One of the Book of Daniel, looking at the prophetic Old Testament wrap-ups to end-time events, and then followed it with the Revelation of St. John, attempting to work out the harmonizations of those things from the New Testament lens. It is interesting to note, for those interested in eschatology and end-times prophecy, that there was no United States when Newton wrote his observations. This makes for some fascinating conclusions about the things that modern scholars love to affix to the super important United States America, particularly Daniel 7:4, which is right on the edge of humorous, but I don't know what to say. He affixed 2034 as one potential fulfillment date, as well as 2060, but never elaborated heavily on either. He also subscribed a timeline that said that Rome would be destroyed by volcanic activity in or around 2016. Now, of course, that didn't happen, but, you know, hey, a guy's observations can be off, but they can also be completely wrong. Newton died in 1726 and is buried in Westminster Abbey. Inscribed on his tomb in Latin, and it is translated into English thus. Here is buried Isaac Newton, knight, who by a strength of mind almost divine and mathematical principles peculiarly his own, explored the course and figures of the planets, the paths of the comets, the tides of the sea, the dissimilarities in rays of light, and that what no other scholar has previously imagined, the properties of the colors thus produced. Diligent, sagacious, and faithful, his expositions of nature, antiquity, and the Holy Scriptures, he vindicated by his philosophy the majesty of God, mighty and good, and expressed the simplicity of the gospel in his manners. Mortals rejoice that there existed such, and no great an ornament of the human race. He was born December 25th of 1642 and died the 20th of March in 1726. What an inscription. One last irony that must be explored, however. As I mentioned, the Lucasian connection between Isaac Newton and Stephen Hawking. But something else is interesting. At the end of A Brief History of Time, Hawking briefly discusses Einstein, Galileo, and Newton, and he immediately assails Newton as unpleasant and devious. Well, the issue is, number one, Hawking had the luxury of at least understanding Newton's work, and Newton, of course, knew nothing of a, at times, non-existent Hawking. But he did predict and warn the discipline against something Hawking would ultimately would do. Hawking would follow up A Brief History of Time with another book called The Grand Design, a tantalizingly provocative title for a book that was going to immediately dispense with any of this God nonsense out of the gate. He writes this in the beginning, quote, we each exist for but a short time, and in that time explore but a small part of the whole universe. But humans are a curious species. We wonder, we seek answers, living in this vast world that is by turns and cruel, and gazing at the immense heavens above, people have always asked a multitude of questions. How can we understand the world in which we find ourselves? How does the universe behave? What is the nature of reality? Where did all this come from? Did the universe need a creator? Most of us do not spend our time worrying about these questions, but almost all of us worry about them some of the time. Traditionally, these questions are for philosophy, but philosophy is dead, unquote. So Hawking's book proceeds to make the argument that every last tittle of matter in the universe was affected and brought into existence by gravity. Interesting enough for sure, but Newton knew this argument was coming, and he warned against the utilization of gravity as an explanatory source. And he also stated this: this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent being. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all. And on account of his dominion, he is wont to be called Lord God or universal ruler. The supreme God is a being eternal, infinite, and absolutely perfect. Anyway, so there you have it. Scientist, alchemist, theologian, and heterodox doctrinal roustabout. And God bless him. Oh, and one last thing. I wish Hawking and Newton could have lived in the same time frame to debate, and I've read enough of both of them to realize something interesting Hawking mentions in the quote I just quoted from his book. It was these questions. How can we understand the world in which we find ourselves? How does the universe behave? What is the nature of reality? Where did all this come from? And did the universe need a creator? Five questions. But only the first two questions are actually questions of science. The last three are philosophical. When you add Hawking's summarizing proclamation, philosophy is dead, we already have a problem and a cleanup on aisle four. Philosophy is dead is in fact a philosophical statement. Or as Newton might say, quod erat demonstratum. And this is box number 7.